to Art If,
the podcast about art, life, and everything in between. Welcome back to Art If Podcast. This is episode 10. I'm Hattie.
And I'm Yossi. In this week's gallery, we talk about art and technology. Technology is something that has had such an impact on our lives over the past few months, and we wanted to think about how technology has shaped our artistic practices as well.
And then we interview media and performance artivist and scholar Sahar Sajjadieh about the new artistic possibilities that ever-changing technologies offer our lives.
And as always, we end with a provocation. This one asks you to have fun with your daily practices. And perhaps will even result in some original music.
If you love this podcast, be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to get the latest episodes and minisodes. So for the gallery today, I'm talking about cars.
Amazing. You know, my mom likes to tell this story how my high school class went to the Getty Museum and I snuck away to go to the Peterson Automobile Museum in LA instead of Lackland.
Really?
Because I love cars.
Do you?
Yeah.
I do not.
Okay. Do you know what car I drove in high school?
I knew at one point you had like a fancy Mustang.
No, it was a 1968 Cadillac convertible. So that was 20 feet long, 8 feet wide. It was like a boat.
Oh my goodness.
Her name was Miss Adelaide.
Do you still have it?
I do. It's in Arizona.
And so it just like sits in a garage, like kept?
Yep. And it's a beautiful machine. It's a beautiful piece of art. So I'm so excited.
Do you have any intention of like ever using it as a car?
It's hard because I don't have a garage where I lived. If I did, gotcha. I would bring it up here.
Wait, so tell me what you love about it.
Well, I always like mid-century design. I always have, even before it was trendy again with Mad Men. But I really wanted a car with fins. Just because the lines, right? And it's made out of the steel. And it's like, each, like, the front fender has, like, a shape and a honeycomb pattern. And it's just, they're beautiful pieces of work. Like, cars now don't have any personality. Like, those yeah. had personality.
I feel the same way. I've never actually been attracted to the way cars look. So I've never really thought of them as artworks. And I definitely, even with, like, the fins of those cars, I attributed all of the design elements to functionality.
Oh, but those look like spaceships. I mean, unless those cars yeah. would, like, take off, you know?
Well, so I assumed that it helped with the aerodynamics.
Oh.
Right? Because of the spacey sort of aesthetic, I assumed that to look like a spaceship, spaceships presumably are very aerodynamic and they go very, very fast. And so I assumed that those design choices were a matter of aerodynamics and functionality. And I think that is not necessarily the case.
I don't think so. That car is not super fast.
No. I mean, it's also huge.
It's huge.
Apparently.
And it's steel. It's like heavy.
Yeah. And so I then also like in terms of like car people, whenever I heard people talking about cars, not that that happens very often in my life.
But out there. There's like hot rod shows and things.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I always thought that what they cared about was the mechanics underneath, the engines and like the cylinders, whatever those are. And like
horsepower.
Right? Yeah. I always thought that was like the biggest draw. And I'm sure that for some people it is, mm-hmm. but a lot of these car shows, especially like historic car shows, right? They are all about the aesthetics. Mm-hmm. And so I was actually, I watched, did I tell you about this show on Netflix that's called Abstract?
Yeah, I did. Episode. I watched a few. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So I watched one about cars and car awesome. Design.
Awesome.
And so I was like floored about how they approach car design. And the person at the center of this episode first and foremost thinks of himself as an artist, not an engineer. And so he talked about looking at the car from the front and like the eyes of the car and sort of anthropomorphizing it and like thinking about it in terms of shape and line. And but there were a few things in terms of like car design that I was also fascinated about in terms of how they sort of shape the way he thinks about things. And his priorities are placing this particular model that he's working on in a lineage of cars.
Uh-huh. Okay, that makes sense.
So the history of this car brand is really important, and then also how it holds up in the market 10 years in the future. Mm. So, like, the changes that you make to the lines, do they both echo those historic cars, and will they still be pleasing 10 years in the future?
Interesting. So it's very much like a design that has, like, one foot in the past and one foot in the future.
Yeah.
Interesting.
He also talked about designing for other car designers.
Okay.
Right? And so there's a way in which they're designing for the public and they're trying to be tastemakers, but really their target audience is other car designers.
Interesting.
Right? Who respect the history of the car and can, right, see those innovations that they're making. Probably, especially in terms of like the bureaucracy of car design, like it's big business.
It is big business.
And so they're also thinking a lot about branding and making sure what they're designing looks like that particular brand and what that brand stands for.
Okay.
And like that to me is a really, big endeavor because it, as an artist, right, it's not about your vision. It's about you interpreting the brand in a particular way.
Interesting.
Yeah. So there's like a whole bunch of brand loyalty. And so this particular person worked for, he's out of Detroit. So okay. That's another then factor is he's working on a sort of a future or a more futuristic car. And he was talking about automated cars and the West Coast really has their handle on the market there. And Detroit is not the
center. Right, because you have, like, the Google cars and Tesla and all of those self-driving.
Yeah.
Okay. But Detroit does feel somewhat in the past when it comes to innovation.
And so he's also thinking about, like, as a designer, how does he represent Detroit? And how does he get Detroit's name back into the game in terms of car design? And I think we probably think of Detroit as manufacturing rather than design.
Yeah, I mean, I do.
But yeah, it was... When he's thinking about a car design, he's thinking about things that I would never, I don't know, I just didn't imagine thinking about.
Yeah.
And then he moves on to work for Fiat, which is an Italian brand.
Federos,
and
sort of, it's like stands for something, Federation of Italian Automobiles, something.
Oh, wow.
It's an acronym.
Awesome.
Yeah. Or if you want to be, I'm Italian, you know the joke, right, of what Fiats are called?
No.
Okay, I'm going to preface it by saying I'm Italian, not that it makes it okay, but they were actually pretty famously terrible in the 80s when they first made their U.S. impression. They would break down a lot, so they're called Fix It Again Tonys.
Oh, no.
So,
awesome.
But they've been new and improved, is from what I've heard. So
cool. Another thing about like the designing process that I thought was really interesting is the time span that they're thinking about.
Okay.
Because when I think of tastemakers, I think of like throwaway fashion.
Right, or like super trendy, what's hot. Yeah.
Yeah. And so with clothing, that changes every year, every season. And so he's thinking about a 10-year time span into the future, that a car is really on the market for about 10 years.
Right, because you don't, unless you're super filthy rich, you're not buying a car every year.
Right. But he also described that as really long term.
Okay.
And so in relation to other art forms like paintings that we have that have been around for, right, hundreds of years or longer.
Yes.
just the idea of just the way he thinks about time was really interesting to me. And there were people who were interviewed who talked about, you know, cars being around for 40 or 50 years, and it's so long. It's so, there's so much history here. And I was like, that's not so much history. Like, no. It's very contemporary. This right. is a very short history.
My car is like just over 50 years old. So, and that's long for a car.
Yeah.
But short yeah. for most other things.
All right. So then it got into sort of how cars are made.
Okay.
And I'm not going to go through a whole lot of process here, but one, a couple of things were really fascinating to me. One, they still make full scale clay models of the cars.
Wow. Why?
So they do all this AutoCAD designing on the computer. And then, I think this is very new. They can send those designs to a machine that carves it out of clay.
Oh, that's cool. So almost so like a 3D printer, but out of
yeah,
clay?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it carves it out of clay, at least the basic structure. But then they go in by hand and refine and get all the details in. And there's actually a whole bunch of YouTube videos of people carving the clay cars. And even from scratch, from the like original block, doing all of the carving. Because I think when you're just looking at it at a computer screen, it's totally different from being able to see it in real life.
So, but it's just so weird. Like, it feels like so antiquated as a process.
It does. They introduced clay modeling into the design industry in the 1930s.
Can you hear her?
And it's, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that was Lulu.
Sorry. Sorry. That's she's, okay. She's trying to get in the door.
Oh. Hi, Lulu. yeah, so clay modeling entered into the design process in the 1930s and has been a part ever since. And it kind of sounded like it's not going away, that being able to see the car in full scale, they can step back and they make minute changes to a line along the side or where exactly the window hits or where the handle goes or moving a wheel forward like a half an inch to change the center of gravity on it.
I mean, it makes sense to me, like, that they would do a scale model, but, like, why not a scale model out of the actual materials that, like, with wheels that move, you know what I mean? Like, that's yeah. what seems weird to me is, like, why make a clay model? I mean, at this point, you think there'd be the technology. I mean, there are, like, there are toy cars.
Yeah.
So that's what's it's interesting to me about the clay. It's like, it feels like...
Well, I love it. I love that there's still this human element.
Yeah, it does. It feels right? very, like, tactile. Hands-on. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Well, so he's also talking about cars as, like, a third home. Mm. And so I think having that human involvement in that contact helps make sure that that's there.
I'm definitely going to look at my car differently. Been like, you were a little yeah. clay model once upon a time. And now yeah. you're on the streets.
And then I started thinking about, like, well, because I don't like most cars, like, they also talked about how a car often represents the personality of the person who drives it. And so I went online to look for iconic movie cars and think about the characters who drive them. And it turns out I don't watch car movies.
Okay.
But I did pull a couple that I thought were noteworthy. So the Wayne's World car.
Yes.
It's a 1976 AMC Pacer.
Yep. I can picture it.
And it looks really wimpy. Yeah. That was my first impression. It's like pointy on both ends,
yep.
but it's also blocky.
Yep.
And so it's kind of awkward. It looks really lightweight and flimsy, but it does not look fast.
No.
The proportions are, like, weird because the center, the cabin is really blocky, but then the hood and the trunk are very narrow.
Yeah. Well, so it makes sense. Like, it's like that's what someone who is living in their parents' basement would drive.
Right. It totally matches the personality of those, yeah. those dudes. And then I looked at the Big Lebowski.
That one I don't know.
He drives a 1973 Ford Gran Torino.
Okay.
So it has like a much lower center of gravity, and the cabin, the center of the cabin sort of sits back farther towards the back wheel.
Okay.
And so like it kind of gives this impression that it's like relaxing.
It's laid back.
It's laid back. The windows are also small.
Okay.
And all of the like lights and handles are like really basic and kind of blocky. It's not very frilly. So it definitely has this no frills kind of attitude, and it feels really grounded.
Makes sense.
And then the Dukes of Hazzard 1969 Dodge Charger.
Yeah. Iconic.
Yeah. And it's, so it's shaped a lot like the Gran Torino in terms of like being a little bit blocky, but the center of gravity is more forward. So it feels more aggressive. It also sits higher up. And so it feels just like it's going to plow through.
Are you doing a performance analysis of cars?
I am.
Awesome.
You know why though? I'll tell you why I'm doing it, because of Jay Leno.
Oh, okay.
Because in one of the videos I watched, he is talking about a car, and I don't remember which one, but he says something about how it feels urban. Mm. And I was like, oh, that's code.
Okay.
And so I was like, okay, now I need to know more about like how these elements of design can or do, or why people might be attracted to certain things, right? Like, is there a way we walk or a way we move, right? Like sports cars are light and agile, and this is the same for motorcycles, right? Like Someone who rides one of those sportster motorcycles that have a really high center of gravity, they also tend to be like muscly bros. Whereas like someone who rides a low rider, everything about their body is typically different, okay, right? It's a different person. Then I took a quiz to see what kind of car I should drive.
Okay, and?
So it said I should drive a 1976 Volkswagen Golf.
I know that, yeah. I can see that.
Yeah.
I want to take this quiz.
Okay, I'll send it to you.
Did you feel seen or not seen? Did you like, you're like, yeah, I got that, or like, how did you feel about getting that result?
I felt like there was some accuracy to it.
Okay.
Yeah, because it's not cool, and I don't think it ever was.
I think you're cool.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's as dorky as the Wayne's World car.
No.
But it's also not, I don't feel like I, it looks mechanical, it doesn't look electrical.
Mm.
Right? And so it's a little bit closer to earthy.
Okay.
I think, than, like, the new age cars. Mm-hmm. So.
Cool.
I came without a fucking preamble, and I still went way too long.
Oh, I thought, well, at a certain point, I was like, is this the preamble, or is this her thing?
No, this is the whole thing. I'm okay. Done now.
Lulu is sitting behind the whole setup. It's adorable. I should just probably take a photo. She's, like, my sound block.
Oh, cute.
Okay, so I am going to go a little more, like, obvious. And a part of this is because I tend to just go with, like, what I've seen. Like, I try, for the most part, I'm like, oh, what have I seen that says that? So, like, last week or whatever that was with the Gorilla Girls, I had seen their exhibit in Minneapolis. So this person I've seen, and I think once was at the Getty in LA, and then another one. I saw his work twice.
I usually just Google our theme and see what comes up.
I mean, that works too.
That's why mine are so random.
But I think that's great. Whereas, like, I feel like I'm just talking about stuff I know, which I'm like, and then I do research on them because I'm like, well, I can't just be like, one time I saw this really cool piece. I can't tell you anything more about it, right? Like, I don't know what it was called. But, I'm going to talk about the artist Bill Viola. And So I saw Bill Viola, and I just looked, and this piece that I saw first was called The Passions. And what it was like a big, long room, like as is standard in a museum. And there were video screens.
Okay.
Okay. And on the video screens were actors doing different emotions, but then the video was really slowed down. So it was like recognizable as crying, but it was not in real time. So it was like you were seeing all these micro facial, because it was like a medium shot. So it was just, yeah. And so the loop would be like a minute or two of like a single tear, right? So like what would normally take 5 or 10 seconds would take that long. So you were seeing all of these like micro distortions of the face. And then there was like laughter, and then there was, you know, anger, and there were sort of like different close-ups of people. And so he, it turns out he does this sort of thing a lot. And what he's really interested in is exploring the themes of life and death and emotion and humanity in the same way that the Renaissance painters did. So he also has a series of quintets where he poses them in like tableaus and then slows down their emotion. Another one I saw was people like plunging into water. And this turns out, this one is called...
Have you ever watched a dog lapping up water in slow motion?
No. Is that... Are you a video artist?
No, I just go on YouTube and watch weird stuff.
Well, then maybe they're artists.
Well, because I heard dogs... you think they lap by scooping forward, but they pull it up. Their tongue curls backwards. And so I was like, prove it, YouTube.
And?
They do. It's cool.
Oh, okay. Awesome. So it's not cupping. It's like a...
It's like an elephant.
Okay. Oh, interesting. Yeah. So this is called Five Angels for the Millennium. And there's these slowed down images of like people... like either falling or coming out of water. Ooh. And that one was put in a room where it was like just that. So you're just surrounded by this like water and bodies and sort of things. So,
and are the screens like the full size of the wall, like scale wise?
That one, yeah, this one was. So those are the two pieces I saw, was the Five Angels for the Millennium and the Passions. And so it's interesting because on one hand, the Passions is about like these micro expressions, mm-hmm. and the sort of the small, and the other one felt very big. It was like about life and death and rebirth and floating and
epic.
And yeah, and like it felt epic. You walked in and it was just this like big thing versus these smaller screens that you interact with more on a daily basis. And he had another piece where he had people just watching video cameras as if they were watching TV. So it was called like reverse television. So just like and then that was the art, was like videos of them watching the video camera as if they were watching television. So it's like
reversing
the gaze.
So they're not actually watching anything.
No.
And so any expressions they have are manufactured.
Yeah.
They're not reacting.
No, I haven't seen this one, but I don't think so. Yeah. It's like they're watching the video camera as if it were a television.
Huh.
And what I just think is really interesting about this is... you know, a lot of art and technology I've seen sort of either goes, and that, I mean, this is this, you could go into a whole discussion about film here, which I'm going to leave aside because I think that's like a whole nother 5, 7, 10 galleries. But when I've seen like technology used in museums or museum art or gallery art, it tends to veer into the unnatural or things that maybe you couldn't capture in other ways, mm-hmm. whether it's like the technology modifies something existing rather than honing in on it. And a lot of these pieces actually do feel like Renaissance paintings, especially the ones that they're like are posed, or the way that the body's used, or this sort of depiction of sorrow, right? Like, 'cause you see those old saints that are like crying, you know, and it, so there's something about it that feels very traditional in spite of the medium.
Does it feel like, are you compelled to watch until the end? Or is...
yeah.
Because...
like, and over, and with the emotion ones, you're over and over again. It's fascinating. It's like a trance.
Yeah.
Because it's familiar, but it's slowed down, and you're seeing it on like a much different scale.
Interesting.
And it feels pure or something. There's like this pure sadness.
So, or pure joy. It doesn't feel like it's telling a story, though.
No.
Okay.
No.
Cool.
It's like about these bigger ideas. It somehow is able to distill the human experience into bigger ideas, just like I think a lot of good art does.
Yeah. Well, I feel like that's also the way I often look at a painting is you see it and then you see it again, right? And you're kind of like looking for more details and moving around and watching different parts of it. And so even if it's not changing over time, you do have this sort of time lapse that you're experiencing it in. That's very different from watching a story.
Well, and there's a lot of loops in his, so maybe that's why it does feel like more of a painting than like a narrative. So it does feel like looking at a painting, but a moving paint. Like prior to Harry Potter, which now, you know, exclude the author from this conversation, but like this idea of, it felt like a living painting as opposed to a film, for sure. A lot of the work that I've seen of his. And I don't know. I think like it feels in some ways like a very conservative use of technology in terms of like sticking to the sort of tried and true topics of like art history.
Yeah.
However, like it's very moving and it makes you think about human emotion on a different level.
He's also using the technology in established ways, right? Like, slowing something down is something that most of us have the capability of doing.
I think he was on the early side of a lot of that.
Oh, okay.
So like, I mean, he's been working with video and projection since like the '80s.
Okay.
So, in terms of even like looping, like that's something that we can make GIFs on our phone now.
Yeah.
But he was doing this in like the early 2000s.
Cool.
So in terms of some of that, I do think he was on the forefront of that.
Neat.
Yeah. And they're gorgeous. I mean, they're just gorgeous. And they're really moving. I mean, I've spent a long time in that room with the faces.
Cool.
Cool. Well, art and technology.
All right. I am so excited to welcome our guest today, multi-talented performance artivist Sahar.
So my name is Sahar Sajidia, and I'm an Iranian-Canadian digital performance and media artivist, which is artist and activist, and scholar, and I'm also a software developer. And my background is in theater and computer science. I did a double major in my undergrad at University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Then I did my master's in performance studies at Tisch, NYU with Yasi, and then I did my PhD. So I recently have completed my PhD degree in media arts and technology at the University of California, Santa Barbara.
Congrats.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So about my art, so basically my art and research, art practice and research, lies at the intersection of interactive performance and media art. And human computer interaction, or HCI, in computer science, and also media and performance theory. And I'm interested in the application of digitally mediated interactivity and using immersive environment, using virtual robotic embodiment and intelligent system in live performances or in public venues. And I'm interested in using them as my means of storytelling, poetic expression, and also sociopolitical intervention.
Awesome. So, why is the digital realm, or why is media so impactful for you in sort of disrupting public spheres or human relations? Like, what is it about, let's just jump right into it, technology, really, that allows you to say something differently?
So, well, first of all, I use technology and see technology as my means, as my tools for my creation. And I think it using the most updated tools of our time, which is the digital technology, which is virtual and augmented reality at this point, which is using interactive media and using machine learning, can give us many more possibilities for interactivity, for new embodiments in both in our society, in public sphere, which can be physical public sphere or can be virtual environment, which is, you know, now the dominant spaces of interaction, especially in this COVID-19 situation. And also it gives us a lot of new tools for expression, for communication, and even for creating new aesthetics. So,
you're talking about new possibilities for different kinds of physicality or embodiment and aesthetics. What do you see as that suggests to me that you see some limitations? What is it that you're trying to get at? What are you trying? What are we limited by? What's the problem?
But like with the human body or with the human, what the problem with what, humanity?
With humanity. I mean,
we don't have all day. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, okay. You talked about physicality and you talked about emotions and you've talked about aesthetics. Mm-hmm. So is there one of those in particular that speaks to you that, or that was your entree into this expansion or?
Well, so let's say body is obsolete, use Stella Arts. Notion. Well, I'm kidding. I don't think about that. But that's what he thinks. He thinks human body is obsolete and we use technology to give it more power and control. But I don't quite.
I think there are plenty of ways in which the body is not obsolete, but.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't understand how I live without my body.
All I know is my body hurts a lot right now because I've been moving. So it is real.
Yeah, so I'm sure he has some argument on the other side, but I'm also more, you know, in this side of the spectrum. I agree with you. I like my body. I like live performances because of the existence of a live human performing body. But for me, actually, there is this question of what is next? What happens when our relationship with our environment, with each other, changes using the dominant technology of our time? And at the same time, when there are new types of technological bodies that we have to interact with in, you know, different contexts in our daily activities or in specific context. So that's why I'm interested in. I have this love-hate relationship myself with technology. And, you know, so I'm trying to explore it and I'm actually bringing it back to live performance space in different forms in, as you know, you ask in by creating new types of interactivity or by creating aesthetics using new types of tools, or even I create new technological performing bodies, which I call them techno actors. And I have been.
Can you give us what is a techno actor? Because right now I'm just picturing an actor dancing to like, so like, can you tell us what that might look like?
Yeah. So basically techno actors is this term I talked about it a lot, actually, in my dissertation. And, you know, it's something that have been, I guess, part of performing arts, live performing arts, since the futurist performances. But they gain new shapes and new types of interactivity in our time. So, for example, any types of technological body that interacts with you, from telepresent body to robotic bodies to virtual puppets, they're all considered as techno bodies or even chatbots. They come chat with
you. Does it have to be anthropomorphized, or can it be my computer or my microphone or?
But I guess is it because they're acting? So we like view that action as something that like is of a sentient being? Is that the difference?
I would say so. I mean, I would say there are techno bodies and there are techno actors. So mm-hmm. for something to be considered as a techno actor, it would be a technological body that would interact with you or the space or other bodies in a performance context, in a performing art stage.
Is Alexa an example?
Alexa can be, but is not necessarily. So if you use Alexa in a way that you can consider it as a performing agent in your performance space, then
my smart TV the other day like went to like a screensaver and it said, ask me to tell you ninja jokes. And I said, okay, Alexa, tell me a ninja joke. And she sure did.
Who needs comedians when you got Alexa?
And of course, and is gaining agency now telling you what type of joke. You should be, yeah.
She's like a three-year-old, like, hey, ask me a question.
Wow. Yeah, but she doesn't ask me to tell her ninja jokes. I think that's...
No?
No, I don't know. Maybe she does. I don't listen.
You have been given, your Alexa some agency, it seems.
Yeah. So. But wouldn't be considered a performance, because, like, unless Hattie, your living room is a stage. I mean, okay... Let's not go into what a performance is. Actually, never mind. I'm not going to open that can of worms.
Yeah, but you can use your Alexa in performance, or you can, you know, consider it as a performance for you and for Alexa, and you know, have your one person, one audience member performance in your living room, and that is totally fine.
Do you want these sorts of techno agents to have a larger presence in our life?
I don't know. I, again, have mixed feelings towards it. So I am one of those people who gets super agitated interacting with customer service automated system. And also mm-hmm. even with chatbots, most of the time, I just want to kill myself. And I'm trying to find a way to find an actual human being on the other side. And actually, that's why I'm interested in this. Like many times you're trying to figure out if it's a human on the other side or not. And that's my main question in my research and my art practice. And actually my research is a very practice-based research. So I create artworks as part of my research and I develop these technologies. So I even make chatbots. And one of my art pieces was even a chatbot that was implanted in the body of a human-sized female robot that was interacting. Oh. Yeah, that was going around an art gallery and finding her favorite and started flirting with that person and trying to get his or her phone number.
That's amazing.
So how does a chatbot flirt?
Okay, so...
Did you have to write all these algorithms?
Yes, of course.
Okay.
And we were writing algorithms and we were collecting data constantly. We took it, so I had a collaborator, and we basically designed a system. It's so that the robot had a Roomba underneath it, and it had a sensor and camera, and it had a microcontroller and Raspberry Pi as its processor. So it was basically going around. It had also this...
Wait. Pause. What is a Raspberry Pi?
Okay,
let's... I'm like, now I'm hungry. Bodies are not obsolete. I'm hungry.
Basically, it's like this easiest way to put it. It's this mini computer that we used as the brain of this robot that we designed. And
so next time you want to flirt with your chatbot, you're like, your Raspberry Pi is delicious.
No.
Yeah, but that came out way dirtier than I meant.
Oh, she would flirt back.
Oh yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Oh yeah.
Good to know.
She would actually approach you. So she has this heat sensor that she would find the hottest spot in a room. And then she, so she would go towards it, and then she uses this facial recognition algorithm that she tries to detect if that thing that is hot has a face or not. And if it, so that she wouldn't end up hitting on a radiator or something.
I feel like that would be fun, you know, if that's your thing.
Yeah, you know. Yeah, sure. It works for some people.
Some people think it's hot. Okay, I'm sorry.
Pretty much, yeah. And her name was Roberita, so she actually did think that radiators were hot first. That's how we decided. We decided to use the facial recognition algorithms, and then she would start flirting with you, and we used this this algorithm that we created based on pickup artist strategies.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's kind of this post-feminist robotic performance art piece that she would basically go to someone. And it could be girl or a guy, and then uses these, follows these procedures using pickup artist strategy. So it would hit on you. It would say, oh, you're the hottest thing in the room. And you are.
Because you are. You are. Objectively.
I feel like in COVID times, this would be a bet. They would, like, she would be able to find out who had a fever.
Oh, there we go.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. She's a nurse. Now she can.
Yeah.
That's a way more pleasing situation than having someone, like, just taking your temperature as you enter the room. Just
that's
have
true. You're little... the hottest thing in the room. Maybe you should go to the doctor.
Get out. Go home.
Yeah. Are you wearing a mask?
Oh, yeah. So she does that. She can go around and do all other types of tasks, I guess. But she would then nag. She would do pulling and pushing. She would even insult people at a time. She would ask you questions. She would invite you to a date. And, you know, this is basically one of the pieces that we created. And
How did people react?
Oh, my God.
Hattie and I had the same programming implanted before this.
Well, maybe you should both come and hang out with Roberita.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, I would love to.
My programming is called chocolate mousse, though, not raspberry pie.
I like strawberry shortcake.
You should keep that. You both should keep that for Roberita. I think she likes that conversation. Yeah. So basically, actually, people's interactions with it was very interesting. And we took it to different performance exhibition spaces. So we showed it at media art exhibitions, both in our department, Media Arts and Technology at UCSB. We took it to Santa Barbara Center for Art, Science, Technology. But also, we took it to a computer science conference called CHI, Computer Human Interaction. And we showed it. It was in Glasgow, Scotland last year. And
oh, cool.
We basically showed it in the performativity, performance and art exhibition and interactivity, section of that. And so people's interaction with Roberita in those different contexts were quite different, actually. And she would find her favorite. So people would gather around Roberita and the person who was interacting with her. And most of the time, actually, it was a very fun experience. People were laughing because we didn't expect this type of interaction. And sometimes even I felt people were a little offended because she would insult them at a point, but then she would try to, you know, joke about it and not insult.
But that's a pickup artist strategy, right? Exactly. It's to like put down the person to make them feel worthless so then you can pick them up easier, right?
I learned about it from Barney on How I Met Your Mother.
I sadly learned about that whole scenario with the shooting at UCSB because that guy So that was like when I learned about what that meant.
Yeah.
So
people had very different reaction to that. And at a point, actually, people's reaction was very interesting because Roberita had a female body and female voice. And that was big part of our piece. We wanted to give this agency to a female robotic actor. and get her to be the one who chooses people and hits on people. And that made a lot of people uncomfortable. Mm. And some were asking us, but how does this work? This doesn't even make sense, you know, because women don't do that. They don't come towards you or hit on you. And that's usually a specific stereotypes of women. And they're saying usually older women do this, or maybe very young girl who are, you know, in porn industry, or, you know, so it's really interesting what, or even.
Yeah. When
go ahead.
It's interesting too, like thinking about, because a lot of our technology, like Siri and Alexa and like all of them are female coded generally. And sure, you can change them, but like this idea that the subservient technology is female. But then I just thought about it as the reverse. And if there was like a large robot coming at me with a male voice and presentation, that's like the stuff of like science fiction horror films. Yeah. Like it's like the world will end when there's an army of robots. So there's something gentle. There's a few different things going on with the female coding, I think.
So we wanted to play around with that and take the agency from the male body or male even digital body and give it to the female body as not only this technological body that serves you, but a technological body that makes choices, that picks her favorite and then follows these series of actions to get what she wants.
Yeah, that's totally fascinating. I have like a two-part question for you. Do you think people's relationship with technology has changed in the last few months with COVID? And I know that you recently did a piece at the beginning of the shelter in place where you had a digital performance poetry performance. So could you tell us a little bit about your performance, like how you felt that was the most poignant thing to sort of reach out to audiences at this time? And then if you think people's relationship with technology has changed.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm a strong believer that our relationship with each other and with our environment is constantly changing because our tool or our technology is changing. And it's basically this famous quote by Churchill that is that first we make our tools and then they form us. And they also later on said that Marshall McLuhan also said something like this. So it's this very famous quote. And so it's basically a type of tool that I think has a prominent role in our daily interaction, and especially in this corona times, because our interaction has got so limited, then it became our main means for our communication, different types of expression, and different types of activities. So definitely, I think it's constantly changing. And in this time, many types of interactions that we were not even used to it, and a lot of us are, you know, against using, for example, this type of technology and video-based interaction for teaching, for performance. As you know, you both know, theater and performance community is not very... is not the biggest fan of the newest technology, right? Both in theory and in practice. And now we have to. That's our only choice. And so it made people much more creative. It has opened the door to different types of exploration in teaching. Even I've seen like all types of new teaching toolkits that are out there, even with, you know, with augmented reality. Yeah. For example, you can use your whole body to teach people and then, you know, draw in the space or interact with the space that basically has nothing, but people on the other side could see things based on your gestures or the options you choose in a toolkit. So yeah, I would say that has changed, and specifically about my piece, So yeah, I did this performance, digital performance work, which is I also consider it as a durational poetry performance called Becoming the 14th Moon, as part of this digital performance exhibition, online exhibition that I was invited to create a piece for called 19 Acts of Bravery for COVID-19.
Cool.
Yeah.
And this was early, right? This was like in March or something,
yes,
right?
This was in March, yes. So this was the time that shelter in place was mandatory and we were all stuck inside. And yeah, we like our interaction was really limited to video-based communication. And for that performance, I even put myself in another level of quarantine in quarantine. So basically I isolated myself in my apartment for 14 days. And 14 in the context of COVID is, as we all know, it's the incubation period of this disease, as well as the number of days that we are required to stay in when exposed to this virus. But also, the 14th night has a very specific cultural and artistic and poetic meaning in Persian culture and poetry. So the full moon in Persian culture language is referred to as the moon of the 14th night.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I connected it to 14 because I wanted to connect it to the beauty of the full moon and all the hope and possibilities that happens outside, and somehow make people feel more hopeful and optimistic towards this situation. So I basically isolated myself inside the apartment and made myself write one poem a day during that time and perform it live on social media every night. And
very cool.
Thank you. And I started it at the new moon, and I ended the performance at the night of the full moon, and I was somehow making this parallel between the interior of my apartment as my landscape and the interior of the outside, which was getting more and more beautiful every night with the moon getting more complete, which I couldn't see, but I was trying to internally make connection with.
Oh, awesome.
Is your poetry typically like separated from your work on technology, or do they often intertwine?
So, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I use different types of media in my artwork. So I do poetry. I used to act and do more theatrical performances, direct, write. Then, yeah, poetry was something that I was doing since I was a kid. And then I do performance art, media arts. So they are different, but somehow I started integrating them more and more over time, so I do digital poetry pieces, and this piece, I think for me, it had all these different components. It had its durational performance art component. It had this poetry writing and reading component, and then it had this connection using digital media, and just performing in front of the camera live is a different story than doing it in front of people. So all these.
I think that's a really nice mixture, because when we're moving into this technological realm of art, we have all those like things that produce the scripts and stuff, and like they're terrible. They're like amazing. And so I think keeping this like human element as really present and always sort of like a part of who you are as you're working through this other technological art, I think that probably really shapes the way you approach things.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, absolutely. Yeah.
No, would you read us some of that poetry that you made for that?
Of course. I can read you guys something.
And then after this, we'll probably move into the provocation, right?
That is exactly right.
All right.
That is exactly right.
Okay. So let me read you this poem. So I perform my pieces, most of them, and I've written them both in Farsi and English. Hmm. So I'm gonna read you this poem from the 14th night. It was the last night of my performance. And
are you gonna read it for us both in Farsi and English?
Sure, I can do that.
Excellent.
Okay. So this poem is called She Naked. Or او برهنه این فارسی. از خانه شب آمده بود او پا برهنه تنها با پیاله شراب در چشمانش. آمده بودم شب تا بعد 14 روز 14 ماه 14 قرن شاید در کاسه ای از آب در یک اقیانوس که زمان در آن معنی ندارد و حجم دگمه بکشاید از پیرهن صورتیش و با صورتی گرد اوریان چون ماه چون آینه ابدیتی را بسازد در دل دریای دور در تاریک نای شب و نور بپاشد در نور با براده هایی از ستاره. She naked. She came from the house of night. Alone. Barefoot. With a glass of wine in her eyes. She came tonight after 14 days, 14 months, 14 years maybe. Where time has no place, in a bowl, in an ocean, in the yearning of the well, to unbutton her strawberry dress. And with a round face, naked, like the moon, like the mirror, to make an eternity in the heart of the sea. She came to splash light in light and pour the stars into fireworks in the silky night.
Awesome. Yay. Awesome. That was beautiful.
Lovely.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. So I think it's time. It's provocation time.
Yeah, I love
that. What do you have for us?
I actually have something in my provocation for you for this provocation sound effect that you're making too. So,
okay.
I have a metal provocation. Okay. So the provocation that I'm proposing, I want to call it the soundscape of our daily ritual.
Ooh.
Okay.
So first, I want you to think about three of the daily activities and rituals that you do either every day or in a regular basis in your week. And for example, some of them can be brushing your teeth, washing your hand in a specific way, or taking shower, typing on a computer, or even walking, and so on. Now, I want to tell you about this technique of actor training and performance making called viewpoint. Mm-hmm. So it's a method that basically teaches and encourages actors to focus more on observation of the movement of their bodies and voice and their interaction with the physical world, with the space, with other actors, object, architecture, and so on, rather than focusing on character psychology.
I want everyone in a grocery store to learn viewpoints.
Exactly. That's
you're like, space. Space.
Awareness. Awareness.
Yeah, please.
We should do this. We should teach people viewpoints and start practicing
in grocery stores.
In grocery stores. In interaction with apples and oranges.
How long will it take for us to get kicked out of grocery stores? Is this a provocation to teach people viewpoints in grocery stores?
actually, sorry. That is part of the thing too, because I'm talking about duration as well. So we can see, we can push that limit to see when we're going to get kicked out by exploring the duration component of grocery shopping. Okay, so for this exercise, I want you to focus on five viewpoints: tempo, duration, repetition, spatial relationship, and topography of any act that you're doing. For example, topography is the trace of the body in the space, in the air, you know, on a table, whatever you're doing, and the patterns, or even the invisible trace of your feet on the ground when you're walking. That could be the topography of your act of walking. So now you have picked your three daily regular rituals, and now I want you, next time you're doing this, pay attention to these five viewpoints, okay, one by one, and try to explore them even further. For example, if you're picking brushing your teeth, first observe the tempo and pace of your movement when you're brushing your teeth. Then start doing it faster. Then,
okay. Is my dentist okay with this?
I hope so, because you will play with it so much. So I'm sure you'll have, you know, beautiful
more toothbrushes.
Yeah. Then you want to do it actually in extreme slow motion. And then you want to do it, you know, to explore the duration, and maybe do it 2 to 3 times longer, which makes your dentist happy. then play with the repetition and add more repetition and figure out which direction, which type of repetition you are following in your act. And then your spatial relationship with the object and with the toothbrush, the angles that you're holding it, the how far or close you stay from the sink, or the shape of your body when you are putting the toothpaste on your toothbrush and then holding it and taking it to your mouth. And then the topography will be the trace of your body, of your arm, of different parts of your body in the space, or even the trace of the toothbrush on your teeth. Mm. So you want to explore all these and pay attention to them and basically experiment with different viewpoints in each of these acts and gestures. And so basically this exercise is about seeing, paying attention, and putting a frame around your daily ritual and experiencing it in a new and fresh way, which is basically a type of artwork that blurs the boundaries between art and life, and it's similar to the happenings and, you know, Fluxus movement, yeah, of the 60s, 70s, and focus basically much more on process as opposed to the product. But I'm giving you this spectrum between process and product, and you can basically choose whichever place you want to do this exercise on this spectrum. So there's an extra challenge, yeah, that I'm giving you, which is when you are doing this experimentation, I want you to record yourself.
So choose your rituals wisely.
I was thinking the same thing. I was going to make it, yep.
Exactly. So it's private and public and kind of fixing that boundary. So choose it wisely where you want to bring the private to public.
Okay.
Is it just an audio recording or a visual recording?
Yeah, so this is going to be only audio recording. And I want you to, you can actually use your phone. So no matter if you use Android or iPhone, you can use the audio recorder app that comes with it. But you can also install different types of app, or even use your computer, install app on that, or use a field recorder, a contact mic even, which picks up more sounds. And also you can put it anywhere you want. So you can, I don't know, put it on the sink, put it in your pocket, hold it in your hand, and experiment with where the microphone goes. And you can also record different versions of this based on your different experiment, and then put all these in a folder called, you know, soundscape of your daily ritual. And you can actually share this folder with each other. So we will hear, we will listen to each other's, to the soundscape of each other's daily ritual. And the final challenge of this would be to use, see, it keeps going, to use a software, a sound editing software like Audacity or GarageBand or something like that, and use some of these files, both yours, your, I don't know, your partner, your friend, your roommate, whoever is interested in doing this with you, and then start composing music or audio art piece using the sound of each other's daily ritual activities.
Okay. Wait, so are we just, do the, each ritual once, or do we have to do like multiple days?
So my provocation is basically choose three acts and explore it extensively once, but that's minimal.
You can always do more.
You can always do more. You can do different versions of it. You can record it differently. My provocation can be as simple as putting a frame, paying attention, explore further those five viewpoints in three activities, or you can take it much further, depending on how.
Are you going to do it with us?
Absolutely. Let's do it.
Yay. Okay. All right. All right. Sounds good. All right. Well, I will make a Google Drive folder then, and we will get started.
Yes. Yes. Perfect.
Well, thank you so much for coming and being a part of this. It was so wonderful talking to you again, and so much fun, all of it.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure. I really enjoyed it. I love this podcast, and I'm very... Very grateful to be part of it.
Oh, thanks. We were happy to have you. So, yay.
Thank you, Sahara. That was super fun and super interesting. I'm definitely going to be thinking about my technologies as bodies.
My body is not obsolete. That's my lesson for today. And thanks, everyone, for listening. If you want to know more about any of the things that came up in our episode today, be sure to check out the show notes.
And don't forget to do the provocation. So take your three rituals, explore them, tear them apart, play with them, record them, and make an original composition. Don't forget to tag us at ArtIfPodcast, #ArtIfPodcast on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And maybe we'll have a whole, like an album
symphony
of all of ArtIf Podcast listeners' daily ritual, the soundscape of daily rituals.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast as much as we are. Be sure to check us out next week. Our gallery theme is art and community. And of course, we'd love to hear your feedback, so be sure to rate and review us wherever you're listening.
Bye! Kordafis, which is bye in Farsi.
'ArtIf Podcast is produced by
Hattie Cry
and Yasi Jahanmir.
Our theme music was composed by Muhammad Abdul Salam.
Follow us at 'ArtIf Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook to stay up to date on upcoming episodes and to join our vibrant community of artists.